Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom, and if there are people listening, different parts of the country, different parts of the world, wherever you are, I'm glad you're listening, whether it be in Kissimmee or whether it be out in Simi Valley in California, near the Ronald Reagan Library, wherever you may be listening. There's a story about an abbey where the monks had taken a vow of silence, but they did get together once a year, and they would just have one monk get up and say a sentence, make a statement. That was all they would allow. And then they would just have to wait till the next year, you know, and so on. Once a year, they would gather together, convene, and one monk would get up and make a statement. Well, that time of year came, and the monks all gathered together, and one of them got up and said, "I really don't like the food in this monastery." Okay, well, that was the statement for the year. Well, they waited for a whole other year, and then they gathered together again that same time the next year, you know. So now it's a year later, and they're gathered together again, and this time another monk stood up, and he said, "I like the food here myself. I think the food here is pretty good." Well, that, you know, they all had to then go back to their various duties in the monastery. A year went by, and finally the day came, you know, for them to all get together again, for somebody to make a statement. This time, as they all gathered together, the head abbot arose from his place, and he said to all of the assembled monks, "We're not going to have any speaking here at all if we don't stop this bickering." But obviously, you know, we do need to communicate. Communication is essential, and it's really essential, I suppose you could say, to sanity. It's essential to human progress. But God did, in a way, complicate human communication in order to suit his purpose for human beings, and obviously he had good positive reasons for doing so. And he made it so that different ethnic groups had languages which enabled them to communicate with one another and in effect reinforce their own particular contribution that they make to the human family. But at the same time, other groups had other languages, and so there was a certain separation that occurred among people, which really did slow down, you could say, human progress. However, what it actually slowed down was the kind of progress that leads to human self-annihilation. Had we been able to just freely exchange information all these centuries, we might have had centuries earlier, we might have had something like what happened in the 20th, where we had world wars, and what may eventually happen in this century, which could even be a lot worse. I mean, we do have the potential of literally destroying all human life from off the planet. That is not just something that somebody can say who's a sensationalist. It is theoretically possible with the arsenal of weapons that we have at present. And now I hear in the news, I read in the news or see that a new nation, Iran, may become part of the nuclear club if it isn't already. So we have more and more nations, India, Pakistan, the State of Israel, North Korea, France, United States, USSR, China. I may have not named them all, you know, countries that actually own maybe at this very moment nuclear weapons. And so that potential would have been there a lot sooner had scientific progress been possible at an earlier time. Also imagine the tyrannies and abuse of power that could have existed as technology could be misused the way, for example, it has been misused by certain regimes, such as recently in Iraq or such as Hitler did. So there was both a positive and a negative reason, one could say, for separating us linguistically. One was so that the world would be populated, people would spread out and populate different parts of the world, and also so that ethnic groups could develop a sense of self, a sense of identity, and then on the negative side, to keep people from human beings as a whole from progressing too rapidly and, in effect, endangering the very existence of the human race too early in its history. So I wanted to talk on the subject today of going from rebabbled to debabbled. Going from rebabbled to debabbled. You could pronounce it Babel, B-A-B-E-L. We do have a verb in English, though, also babbling, you know, with two B's, babbling. But I'm talking here about, of course, the Tower of Babel or the Tower of Babel. Later on in the Bible, the area is called Babylon. But the Tower of Babel episode is a very dramatic episode and very significant in the Bible, Because if you really think about it, science cannot really fully explain, I believe, the phenomenon of language in terms of why we have the many languages we do and how they developed and differed. Yes, a lot can be explained scientifically, but how language developed, I think, is something that still we cannot really fully explain. How the human family, which is all, of course, one family of beings, ultimately, you know, with a common descent, how we could have developed all the different languages that we have developed in the way that they have developed. And quite frankly, if you study into languages, you'll find that some of the so-called primitive languages are actually more complex grammatically than contemporary languages. In other words, if you go to primitive peoples that have been relatively isolated and are speaking a very ancient conservative language that has perhaps changed very little, it's more complex grammatically, and yet these are people that they're not even a literate society, and yet they have a very complex language, whereas here in the modern 20th century, some societies, their grammatical structure is not as complex. And you see the trend in languages is towards simplification. The King James English, in some ways, was more precise than the English we speak today, because you have certain grammatical forms that we don't have anymore, because we prefer to keep it simple and maybe a little more ambiguous, but simpler. So actually, even English has been simplified over the centuries. So it kind of flies in the face of the concept of evolution and things developing from the simple to the complex. Language seems to go in the opposite way, from the complex to the simple. Well, in God's revelation to human beings, he does show that it really took a miracle to produce the linguistic environment that we see today. It wasn't just a matter of human development, though that is a factor, obviously. Languages have developed in human history. From Latin, we have the so-called Romance languages. You know, so we do have languages that develop from other languages, and we do have things that happen within languages and dialects and accents and all of that sort of thing. But there is a piece of the puzzle that's missing, which involves revelation. God reveals that he intervened and miraculously gave different peoples different languages. And that is what I want to talk about today, the fact that God, in effect, rebabbled the human race and eventually will debabble the human race. Now, what do I mean that he rebabbled the human race? Because before the flood, before the Noahian, the deluge of Noah, there were different languages. Archaeology shows that. There were different languages prior to the flood. But there was a unique time in human history after the flood when people pretty much stayed together and didn't separate over vast areas of land for a time. They stayed together for a time. And because there were eight people who survived the flood and they could all understand one another, we had a situation where the community of human beings a few generations after the flood continued to understand each other and have one common language among themselves. That was a unique time in history. Before the flood, it had not been that way. And God intervened after the flood to once again reinstitute different languages. I wanted to get into that today, talk about that. So that's what I mean by he rebabbled the human race. He once again gave us separate languages, but he will someday debabble us. He will someday develop us to the point where we will be unified linguistically. And I want to talk about that as well. Now, this is talked about in the Bible in a very dramatic way, because it certainly is a very dramatic decision that he made, a decision whose impact is still with us. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about how the decision is presented, how the action is presented in the Bible. And to do that, I want to talk a little bit about the scene we see once in a while when the curtain is withdrawn, as it were, and we look into the spirit realm, and we see heaven, we see God's throne, and we see, in effect, the king and his court. So I want to deal with that today. Of course, this time of year, we tend to think of God as our Father, which we should. And indeed, he does reveal himself as our Father. But he also reveals himself as the Sovereign of the universe, as the King of the universe. You know, there's a very old Hebrew prayer, very traditional prayer, that is recited on during the autumn festival season, the Festival of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. So God is both our Father and our King. And the Bible talks about sometimes his court, and his meeting with other spirit beings, and in a sense discussing the destiny of the universe. It's a really awesome sight when it's talked about. I want to give one example in Revelation 4. So I'm talking a little bit now about the heavenly court, because God operates in a community. He operates in interacting with other spirit beings, And, of course, he eventually wants us to be included, and we're going to even be on a higher plane than the beings he's created so far. But he does have beings far more capable than we are right now, spirit beings with whom he interacts. And he has a court. In effect, we have a monarch and a court. And we can look at Revelation 4 as one example of that. After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, "Come up here, and I will show you things which must take place after this." Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne set in heaven, and one sat on the throne, and he who sat there was like a jasper and a sardius stone in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne in appearance like an emerald. Now, we're not saying this is a photograph, but this is an image that John saw to give him a sense of what it's like on that plane, on that realm. I'm not saying it's necessarily a snapshot or a photo, but it is a vision of that realm of existence. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes, and they had crowns of gold on their heads. On earth, corresponding to this, if you read in the book of Chronicles, there are 24 courses of the priesthood that seem to correspond to these 24 elders in heaven. And from the throne proceeded lightnings, thunderings, and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. Before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. So these are very awesome sights that John saw. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf, the third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. Now there are beings in Ezekiel that have four faces. Each being has four faces of this type, and so you might want to check the early chapters of Ezekiel. But these are four living creatures, and one is like a lion, one like a calf, one like a man, and one like an eagle. Have I mentioned all four? Lion, calf, man, and eagle. Now, traditional Christianity associates these with the four Gospels. You know, the Gospel of Matthew is the lion. Here Christ is pictured as the descendant of David, the king. The Gospel of Mark is the calf. In another place, it's an ox. In other words, here you see Christ working, doing the work of a farm animal in that sense, symbolized by a working farm animal, livestock. Then like a man, we find in the book of Luke, Christ is the quintessential human being, the representative of the human race. He's called the Son of Man. And then the fourth gospel, John, the flying eagle, because there Christ is pictured as, that has the highest Christology, as it were. It speaks of the pre-existence of Christ. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So it has that soaring quality about it. So as I said, in traditional Christianity, they associate these creatures with the four gospel accounts. So if you study medieval art, you'll see that. The four living creatures, each having six wings, were full of eyes around and within, and they do not rest day or night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And, of course, again, this reminds you of scriptures in the Old Testament, which I'm going to turn to in a moment. Particularly, I'm going to turn to Isaiah. "Whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who sits on the throne, who lives forever and ever." Well, I'm in the middle of a thought. I'll keep reading. "The 24 elders fall down before him who sits on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever, and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, 'You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they exist and were created.'" So here you see a heavenly scene. You see worship going on. It's very dramatic. Surely the one who would have seen these vision would have been very highly impacted by it. Now, I'd like to now go to Isaiah. Well, first I want to go to 1 Kings, 22. Here you see sometimes influences that work in the geopolitical world. Sometimes it is God's will that something happen in the geopolitical world, and so he sees to it that it happens. And in 1 Kings 22, I want to go to verse 19. Here again, it's like the curtain is lifted, and we see behind the scenes that there is a spirit influence working in the world. You know, so obviously, if a person wants to study geopolitics and history, then of course that's a field of study. But let's understand that we're not going to know everything about why things have happened the way they have happened in the world, because there are spirit influences that work, and they are not beyond our understanding. So we're not going to be able to just tightly knit everything together just so, as far as why things have happened in the world the way they've happened, because God is working out a purpose. And so some things are simply not, they're not going to fall into whatever explanation you have. Now, when I was a young person, I was very interested in trying to explain human history. And I was fascinated with these different scenarios as to how things can be explained. And of course, one particular one that's been around for so long is the Marxist interpretation of explaining things by economic forces, using economic forces to explain history. Now, that certainly has to be considered. That's, you know, obviously, we have to have food, clothing, shelter to survive, and so economic factors are really very important, but that's not all there is to it. Sometimes people are motivated by certain beliefs that they have and will do things that economically will hurt them because of the belief system that they have. But anyway, I'm going now to 1 Kings 22, and as I said, there is a spirit force in history. This is 1 Kings 22, verse 19. Then Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Eternal. I saw," so he had this vision, as John did in the New Testament. "I saw the Eternal sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by, on his right hand and on his left." So God at times is pictured with this contingent around him. He's called Adonai Tzevaot, the Lord of hosts. Some of you here have heard that in English as Sabaoth in some of the special musical presentations. Adonai Tzevaot, the Lord of hosts. In verse 20, "And the Eternal said, Who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth Gilead? So one spoke in this manner and another spoke in that manner. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Eternal and said, I will persuade him." So here you see behind the scenes that God was allowing a spirit to go and influence Ahab to make a decision that was not really the best, a wise decision, because God had in this way God was going to be dealing with Ahab. So you see that spirit forces can influence decisions of political figures if God allows that. But you see again that the heavenly court, and that's what I wanted to comment on. Now I'd like to go to the book of Isaiah, which I referred to earlier. In Isaiah, the 6th chapter, we have another scene of the heavenly court. And Isaiah gets involved in a way as John does in his account. And here you see beings that are called seraphim, here you see seraphim, like these burning, flaming creatures. Comes from the Hebrew word for burning. Fire. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. And above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings, with two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said," and if you ever go to a synagogue, this is in the services, of course, in the synagogue regularly, "Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh, Adonai Tzevaot, Meloch Kol Haaretz Kevodo. Holy, holy, holy is the Eternal of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And of course, for that matter, it's a traditional Christian hymn that a lot of you have heard. "And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. So I said, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Eternal of hosts." So he was terrified. And besides that, he felt very inadequate, Isaiah did, to the task he was going to be given, as you remember Moses did. Remember Moses said, who am I, that I should be sent, and so on. "Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth with it and said, Behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is purged, is taken away, and your sin is purged." So he has like this burning from the angel to inspire him. This is the imagery you find in the very famous song, Jerusalem of Gold. And some of you have heard that song, and it gets into that imagery. "Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" So here he's speaking to the heavenly court, and he acts as a representative of that realm. And he says, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And then Isaiah steps forward, which is amazing. But of course, the angel had reinforced him, So then I said, here am I, send me. So Isaiah courageously steps forward and volunteers after, of course, being given this special help. And so you see that God speaks to the whole heavenly court and says, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" It's very dramatic. And then, of course, Isaiah is sent. And Isaiah's prophecies are very powerful prophecies and really link up very powerfully with the New Testament material. His book is a very special one in many ways. In fact, the people who translated the Bible have divided Isaiah into 66 books as if it's a mini-Bible. The Bible, in one sense, has 66 books in the English translation, and Isaiah has 66 chapters. It's a kind of a mini-Bible in a way. All right, now let's go to Genesis 1. And again, you see the heavenly court. Now, before I go to Genesis 1, let me first briefly go to Exodus 25. We talked about seraphim. Seraphim. There's another kind of angelic being, keruvim, or cherubim. And you find cherubim, the cherubim design over the Ark of the Covenant. The top of that structure is called the mercy seat, and you have cherubim there. Now, a lot of people, because of modern American culture, they've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. They've seen depictions in Bible textbooks or whatever. Art books or something of the Ark of the Covenant, and they'd seen these cherubim pictured there. So I'm going to jump to verse 17 of Exodus 25, talking about cherubim. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. A cubit is something like about 1.5 feet, 2 feet. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold. Of hammered work you shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherubim at the 2 ends of it of 1 piece with the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings, and they shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. So I think most of us have seen some depiction of this, of the angelic beings facing one another with their wings outstretched, covering the mercy seat. We've probably seen either in the movies or in some Bible commentary or something. And so this talks about cherubim. Well, you know, it's interesting. When you're in the book of Genesis, this background is assumed. You know, the Genesis is part of a collection of 5 books, the 5 books of the law. And early in Genesis, cherubim are talked about. They're introduced without explanation. They're just there. Genesis 3. If you look at Genesis 3 and verse 24, remember that Adam and Eve are driven out of the Garden of Eden. Genesis 3:24. So he drove out the man and he placed cherubim. Now you see that so here they are. I mean, there's no explanation here given. There they are. And so he drove out the man and he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. Now, this didn't have to be there permanently, evidently, but for a period of time, anyway, it was there and protected that garden so to make it clear that Adam and Eve were not to re-enter and were not going to have access to the tree of life in their sinful state. So, again, as I said, cherubim are mentioned here. So one can assume when reading Genesis that the God who created the human beings and created the physical universe had created spirit beings. And spirit beings were already on the scene, and here spirit beings are used to protect the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Life. So let's go back now to Genesis 1, and here we have another example where a dramatic decision is made and the heavenly court is included, where God speaks to his hosts. The king speaks to his court and represents the court in that sense. In Genesis 1 and verse 26, then God said... And, of course, the verb is in the singular. It's he said. You know, then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle, over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So here God, speaking to the heavenly court, says, let us make man in our image. As you see earlier, as you saw in Isaiah 6, you know, who will go for us? So here he says to the heavenly court, let us make man in our image. Now notice in verse 27. So God created man in his own image, created him. Male and female, he created them. So God created human beings, but in the place of divine human, to the image of God, reproducing divine character in human beings, angels have a role to play. God said to the angelic realm, let us make man in our image. We have certain characteristics we share with angels, that angels don't share with other beings. You know, angels have certain capacity that humans have that other beings don't have. Now, in the future, of course, we're going to even have greater capacity than angels. But right now, angels are working for God, in a sense, with us, to develop us. They are part of God's plan for us. we take on fully God's image through the work of angels. Notice in Psalm 104, and verse 30. If you want to talk about angels, you could say that they're kind of like babysitters or like a nanny. You know, they have a role to play to kind of watch over the nobility. We're princes and princesses in training. Eventually, we're going to be kings and queens, priests and judges in God's family. But just as princes and queens when they're and princesses when they're children, they follow a nanny. They're taken care of. They have tutors and people that care for them. That's in effect our status now. Angels are watching over us in certain ways. Notice in Psalm 104 and verse 4. Psalm 104, 4. I'm sorry, did I make a mistake on the verse number? It's 4. Psalm 104, 4. Who makes his angels spirits, his ministers a flame of fire. So here you have references to angels and compared to fire, you know, the power of the angelic realm. And now if we take this verse, I want to take it further over to Hebrews. In Hebrews, the first chapter. Hebrews, the first chapter, which builds on this verse. Hebrews 1, and in Hebrews 1, showing how Christ is so much greater than angels. Hebrews 1 and verse 13. But to which of the angels has he ever said, "Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool"? This is from Psalm 110. No, God hasn't said this to any angel. Christ is greater than any angel. So what are angels? In verse 14, Hebrews says, "Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation?" Oh, so God has chosen to work that way through angels, directing us towards salvation through angels. We worship only God. Angels are not to be worshipped, but we can appreciate the role they play. And later on, you know, we will have the chance to personally thank them later. right now, we can appreciate the role they play, and we can worship God and appreciate the fact that angels are part of how he operates. So with that background in mind, now I want to go to Genesis and talk about how the heavenly court decided to intervene and to see to it that human beings would be speaking different languages. First, let's go to Deuteronomy on the way back to Genesis, because I want to tell you once again that archaeology shows there were different languages prior to the flood, the deluge that covered the earth and destroyed all human life except for 8 people. And this is hinted at in Deuteronomy 32. So let's go to Deuteronomy in verse 32. I'm sorry, chapter 32. Moses is singing here. I don't think Charlton Heston got to sing in the Ten Commandment movie. I don't know what kind of singer he would have been, but anyway, Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8. I'll start with verse 7. "Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you. Your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel." So God was a master geopolitician, and when he did divide human beings, he had in mind that he was going to choose a nation and give it a particular place in the world. So he had that in mind as he divided the nations, their inheritance. But it's interesting how this is worded. Notice it says that God separated the sons of Adam. It doesn't say the sons of Noah. So it is true that God separated the sons of Noah, as I'm going to show you in a moment, but he also separated the sons of Adam. There were separate languages even prior to the flood, as I've said, and archaeology shows. But I'd like to go now to Genesis 11, because here is a world which needed, in effect, to be rebabbled. Because after the flood, 8 human beings, of course, had other descendants, and they continued to live generally close to one another and continued to speak a language they all understood. And notice in Genesis 10, we have here the table of nations. And we have 3 sons of Noah who had wives and children, and the children developed in various ways. And we have within Noah's family, these various races. And we have 3 sons of Noah who had wives and children, and the children developed in various ways. And we have within Noah's family, these various racial groups existed. Within his extended family, he had 3 sons and 3 wives. So within that extended family, the various racial groups existed that have come down to us. Now notice in Genesis 10, when we talk about the children of Japheth, the first son of Noah that's mentioned is Japheth. Look at verse 5. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, and into their nations. So the people of Japheth were separated out, and language played a role in that. Now I'd like to go to the sons of Ham in verse 20. The next son that's mentioned is Ham in verse 20. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands and in their nations. So again, language plays a role in directing the migrations of people. And then finally, with the children of Shem, verse 31, talking about Shem. These were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations. So you see, language was used. All right, now Genesis 11 focuses on how that happened and why. How it happened and why. Now, to get a little background on it, I want to go back to something that is in the 10th chapter of Genesis when we focus on the line of Ham. In verse 6, Ham had a son named Cush, all right? Now, Cush, in verse 8, had a son named Nimrod. So Nimrod was a grandson of Ham and therefore a great-grandson of Noah. So we are a few generations now into history. Cush, in fact, some Bible scholars have speculated that the Tower of Babel episode occurred about a century after the flood. The Bible doesn't specifically say, but it would seem to indicate that it occurred when human beings had developed into these various families that you see in Genesis 10. So several generations at least existed, so we had the various branches of the human family. And it very likely occurred during the time of Nimrod. Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. Now it appears that Nimrod eventually became a kind of adversary, a kind of power in his own right, and a kind of a negative force. Maybe one of the world's first would-be tyrants, perhaps. In fact, his name could mean, "Let us rebel." I doubt that's what it meant when his mother gave him the name, but in Hebrew, Nimrod could mean that, "Let us rebel." Rebellion does seem to be what he's associated with biblically. And notice that he founds Babel, which becomes one of the great civilizations, one of the great pagan civilizations, and eventually, as part of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, makes captive the people of Judah. Much later in history. But if you look at 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. So here you have the Sumerian civilization. This is now the post-flood Sumerians. And you have the Akkadians. The Akkadian language is similar to biblical Hebrew. You have the city of Akkad mentioned here. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. This is the principal city. So he is the one who established a civilization in what is today Iraq, the Babylonian civilization. Now later on in verse 11, you read about the Egyptian civilization on the banks of the Nile. This is the civilization between the rivers of Tigris and the Euphrates, Mesopotamia. And Nimrod is the one who gets it established. And of course, it becomes symbolic of sin, as does Egypt. So the implication would be that he was somebody who had power and influence and was leading people to focus more on him than on God. And so it very likely was Nimrod who organized this tower building of Genesis 11. That is to some degree speculative, though. But I just wanted to bring that out because I think many people who read the Bible draw that conclusion, especially also because of certain traditions that have come down to us. But we want to be careful that we don't read more into the Bible than what is there. In Genesis 11, now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And this was a unique time in human history, as I said, because before the flood it was not so. But for a period of time after the flood it was so, perhaps about a century after the flood. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and they dwelt there. And this is what has been known as Sumeria. It's the Tigris-Euphrates region. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone and they had asphalt for mortar. And notice that they're speaking by consensus. So the human family is coming together and making this decision. So even if you want to blame Nimrod for it, But it's by consensus that they're doing this. The human family is coming together and saying, come, let us make bricks. Notice verse 4. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. So they were opposing the concept of scattering. But evidently it was God's intent that indeed people do resettle all various parts of the earth, and not that they stay in one place. And besides that, if you stay in one place, you can be controlled by one central authority. And God would prefer people to be more independent, because that way at least some people might have their act together. You know, not everybody under one dictator and all going the wrong way. If you have people in smaller groups, some might be salvageable, you could say. But they wanted to all stay together and build a symbol to keep them together. Now, Mesopotamia is very flat. If you build a tall building, you're going to see it from a long way off, and it'll have a very major impact. Now, this building probably is similar to the buildings that you find in ancient Iraq, the so-called ziggurat, these buildings that are built in a step-like pattern and reach up towards the heavens, almost as if you're walking up into the heavens. But this is not called a temple as such. It's called a tower. But the ziggurat, I believe, was more of a temple. But this is a tower here. But notice that this is done really in defiance of God. That's implied here, that they seem to be not wanting to do what God wanted them to do. You know, resettle, repopulate the earth, group here, group there. They wanted to all stay together. But the Eternal came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Eternal said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they prepare, that they propose to do, will be withheld from them. The capacity of human beings is really amazing. And we live in a time now, after many centuries, when cloning is here and all kinds of things are here. And unfortunately, you know, every scientific advancement has that other side to it, that dark side to it. And, you know, people are making hay over it in terms of making money. Hollywood has these movies about clone wars and technology run amok. And, you know, it's not inevitable that it's going to run amok, but there's certainly a chance whenever any new technology comes out that it's going to be used for some vile purpose as well as for a good purpose. And I don't know if there's been any weapon that's ever been developed that hasn't been used. Even nuclear weapons, of course, have been used. God is saying here that human beings would make such rapid progress that unfortunately the progress would lead to the destruction of the human race well before the time he intends. So he has to, in effect, slow it down. So notice what human beings said in verse 3. They said, come, let us make bricks. And notice in verse 4, come, let us build ourselves a city. So now the Eternal, Yahweh, says to the heavenly court, you know, let us go down. You know, so it's like an echo. Okay, the human beings have come together to do their thing. Now we spirit beings are going to come together to do our thing. You know, so it's very dramatic, because he's involving the whole realm there, the heavenly court. And so he says, come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So in Hebrew, balal is to mix or to confuse. The word bavel, the name of Babylon, in Hebrew, bavel is a kind of onomatopoeic form. It sounds confusing to the speaker of Hebrew, the sound itself, babel. And it indicates confusion. It's related to also the root balal. Now, why did they call it Babel? Because Babel means in Semitic languages the gate of God. Bab-il, the gate of God. So maybe they did intend this tower to be some special temple as well. They may have had all kinds of weird notions connected with it because of calling it Bab-il. So in effect, the gate of God becomes confusion because it was not the true God they were wanting to worship. In fact, they were in defiance of the true God here. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Now, we know that God is not the author of confusion. When God gave people different languages, he systematically did it. He gave the different human families their languages so that each family then moved on and they understood one another and maybe didn't understand some other family initially. But in that way, different families could bring out their own particular strengths and contribute to the human family. Unfortunately, that's not how people operate. Differences become reasons to hate one another and fight one another instead of to be appreciated. So that's sad. In other words, different countries live side by side instead of saying, okay, we're good at this, they're good at that, we're weak at this, you know, they're weak at that, whatever it is. You know, we have to create reasons to to hate each other. Now, of course, one simple reason is just simply lust for the land of the other country, just wanting to conquer and take what's there. I mean, that's one simple reason. But sometimes it's not that obvious. It's just more a matter of hating something different, which is incredible, but often what happens. Anyway, in verse 8, so the Eternal scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Eternal confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Eternal scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. So God's purpose cannot be thwarted. You know, he designed that the earth so that people would inhabit various parts of it, and he wanted various groups of people here and there, in individual groups rather than all under one control at that time in history. And so that's what happened. And so from that day to this, we've had different languages. And yes, there have been developments, and even new languages have come along, like English. You know, English wasn't there then. English has a history. It developed from other languages and so on. But there were languages given then to human beings. Now, here God miraculously, by divine intervention, gave this characteristic to people, made them linguistically separate. Now, he did intervene miraculously to bring them all together in Genesis 14, I mean, in Acts 2. So to show what God intends ultimately for people, he unified people briefly in Acts 2. Now, here were people who were commandment keepers. They were Jews, or they were Gentiles who had become religiously Jewish, Jews by religion. They were either Jews ethnically or those who had accepted that religion, and they all came to Jerusalem on Pentecost to keep the festival there. And in Acts 2, when the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. So there was a great unity among those people. Among the disciples there was a great unity in the church. But we're not talking about the church now. We're talking about what happened with everybody else that was there. There were 120 disciples there, but there were many others there, who, as I said, who were part of the Old Covenant religion. And suddenly there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled the whole house where they were sitting. Then there appeared to them divided tongues as a fire, and one sat upon each of them. So perhaps this was letting people know there was going to be a miracle involving language here. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. They began to speak languages that they didn't know, you know, that they hadn't necessarily learned. Notice, and further, and there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men, from every nation under heaven. And just as today, you know, when Jews come together, sometimes they will have a problem communicating. Now, normally, you know, Jews will find some way to communicate. Many, of course, a generation ago, many Jews spoke Yiddish, but not all. Some spoke Ladino, a version of Spanish. And some Jews speak Hebrew today, a lot don't. Probably the best language for Jews to use if they get together now is English. But even then, not everybody knows that. I know that for a fact, because I was in France, you know, and I was talking to somebody, I think she was Jewish, because she was with my relative who was Jewish, but that person didn't speak English. Anyway, verse 5. And there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men, from every nation under heaven. And when this sound occurred, the multitude came together and were confused, because everyone heard them speak in his own language. Then they were all amazed and marveled, saying to one another, look, are not all these who speak Galileans? And how is it that we hear each in our own language to which we were born? In which we were born. Parthians and Medes and Elamites and those dwelling in Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt, and the parts of Libya joining Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians, we hear them speaking in our own tongues the wonderful works of God. So not only was there a miracle in terms of people speaking different languages, but there was also a miracle in terms of hearing. There was evidently a double miracle going on. People could get up and speak different languages, but at the same time others were hearing in their own language what was being said. You know, like there was a translation going on miraculously. So they were all amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, whatever could this mean? Now, human nature being what it is, but this is the way human nature goes. Others, mocking, said, they are full of new wine. I don't care how many cups of wine you give me, I'm not going to be able to give a sermon in Swahili. I can say a few words. I can say jumbo buana, or, you know, I can say a few words. But harambe, I can't give a sermon in Swahili. And I don't care how much wine you give me, but that's human nature. You know, it's not a matter that they were drunk or the people were drunk. This was a divine miracle. as Peter explained later on. But in this way, we were being reunified. We're being reunified linguistically. And God intends that everybody, that the human race, be unified. Now let's notice in Daniel 7, and verse 14, that eventually people of all languages will come together to serve God, not to defy Him. Daniel 7, 14. Then to Him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve Him. See? All peoples, nations, and languages should serve Him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and His kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Now, before Christ's coming, that begins to happen. A lot of people do come together and begin to have a relationship with God such as they never had before from all these different languages. Let's notice in Revelation, the 7th chapter, and I want to go to the 9th verse. After these things I looked, and behold, this is Revelation 7, 9. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb. So the various languages are now united, serving God. Now I'd like to go to Zephaniah, the 3rd chapter. One of the minor prophets, Zephaniah. So God does intend for people to serve Him unitedly, and I think it may involve someday everybody also being able to understand one another, perhaps one worldwide language. That doesn't mean that all languages will be done away with. Maybe there will be national languages, but very likely there will be one international language that everybody will understand. That would seem to be the case in Zephaniah 3:9. Zephaniah 3 and verse 9. For then I will restore to the peoples a pure language. Obviously, when Adam and Eve started, they had a language that they spoke that with one another, you know, and so for a time people did have one language, as I said, both before and after the flood. But then before the flood, God changed languages, and He did also after. But now it seems that we're all going to have one language again. For then I will restore to the peoples a pure language that they all may call on the name of the Eternal to serve Him with one accord. Let's go now to Zechariah, the 14th chapter, and the 9th verse. And this is going to be the state of things in the world tomorrow. People are going to all understand who God is and what His expectations are, what His standards are. And there'll be only one God over the whole earth. And His way of life will be the way that is taught over the whole earth. Zechariah 14 and verse 9. Once again, anybody who goes to synagogue, this verse is so well known. And everywhere around in North America, it's sung to the melody, believe it or not, of the farmer in the dell. How that happened, why that happened, but maybe all over the world, wherever you go to synagogue, Zechariah 14, 9 sounds like the farmer in the dell. But anyway, in English it reads this way. And the Eternal shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be. Yahweh is one and His name one, right? The Eternal is one and His name one. So there'll be no question who God is and what His authority is and what His standards are. And there'll be a certain unity. So this is the way the world is going. Now, as I said, the implication is that there will be one world language. And I'm not saying that there won't be other languages existing. But it does seem to me that there will be one language everybody will know. And then there may or may not be also others for your own individual nation to use. That could very well be. But I think the implication is that people will understand one another. But really what's more important, actually, is not so much whether or not there's one language for everybody, but what's important is that everybody's attitude, everybody's will be such that everybody will be serving the same God. And so we will have an international unity such as has not been the case. Unfortunately, there have been times when people have come together for a wrong purpose, such as at the Tower of Babel. Now they are going to come together for a right purpose, and then God will certainly lift restraints on human endeavor, and human progress will proliferate. It's not going to be a time without progress. There will be progress, but it will be positive. It will be very positive. I'd like to go now to Matthew 6. So just as, in effect, God rebabbled human beings after the flood, He will debabble us in the world tomorrow. We are going to be unified, and very likely linguistically, but certainly in our attitude. and in our purposes. And so the heavenly court will finally rule on earth, and there won't be a competition between what people want on earth and what the heavenly court wants. Rather, there'll be a unity between the heavenly court and people on earth. There'll be a true consensus between the angelic realm and the human realm. So if we go to Matthew 6:10, we find that this is what we're to pray. Matthew 6 and verse 10. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So human beings that have been rebabbled eventually are going to be debabbled. So I hope that this message has been of benefit to those who've heard it, and certainly I'd appreciate your input, and looking forward to interacting with anybody who's hearing this now or perhaps in a tape later on. And we wish you that you'll enjoy certainly the rest of the Sabbath, and that you'll have a wonderful week ahead. Hope to see you, or to be at least interacting with you, next week.